Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prasadane Naravasesha Shunyavadi Paschata Desha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasati Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 10, Verse 26. Aho alam slagya tamam yado kulam. Aho alam punya tamam madorvanam. Yade shapung sangur shabasriya pati. Svajanmana chakra manena chanchati. Aho alam slagya tamam yadokulam. Aho alam punya tamam madorvanam. Yadesha pung sangra shabasri apati. Svajanmana chakra manena chanchati. Marriages. Aho.
Aho.
Oh.
Aho.
Alam.
Alam.
Verily.
Verily.
Slagyam tamam.
Slagyam.
Supremely glorified.
Supremely
glorified. Yado.
Yado.
Of King Yadu.
Of King Yadu.
Kulam.
Kulam.
Dynasty.
Aho.
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 Oh.
Aho.
Alam.
Alam.
Verily.
Punya
tamam,
supremely virtuous.
Madovanam,
the land of Mathura.
Yat, because Aisha,
this
Pungsam,
of all the living beings.
Rishabha,
supreme leader.
Shriya,
of the goddess of
fortune.
Pati,
husband.
Svajanmana,
by his appearance.
Shankramanena,
by crawling.
Chanchati,
glories.
Translation:
oh, how supremely glorified is the dynasty of King Yadu,
and how virtuous
is the land of Mathura,
where the supreme leader
of all living
beings,
the husband of the
goddess of fortune,
has taken his
birth
and
wandered
in his
childhood. Purport in the Bhagavad Gita, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, has expressively given a description of his transcendental appearance, disappearance, and activities. The Lord appears in a particular family or place by his inconceivable potency. He does not take his birth as a conditioned soul and who quits his body and accepts another body. His birth is like the appearance and disappearance of the sun. The sun arises on the eastern horizon, but that doesn't mean that the eastern horizon is the parent of the sun. The sun is existent in every part of the solar system, but he becomes visible at a scheduled time and so also becomes invisible at another scheduled time. Similarly, the Lord appears in this universe like the sun and again leaves our sight at another time. He exists at all times and every place, but by his causeless mercy, when he appears before us, we take it for granted that he has taken his birth. Anyone who can understand this truth in terms of the statements of the revealed scriptures certainly becomes liberated just after quitting the present body. Liberation is obtainable after many births and after great endeavor and patience and perseverance in knowledge and renunciation. But simply by knowing in truth about the Lord's transcendental births and activities, one can get liberation at once. That is the verdict of the Bhagavad Gita. But those who are in the darkness of ignorance conclude that the Lord's birth and activities in the material world are similar to those of the ordinary living being. Such imperfect conclusions cannot give any liberation. His birth, therefore, in the family of King Yadu as the son of King Vasudev, and his transfer into the family of Nanda Maharaj in the land of Mathura are all transcendental arrangements made by the internal potency of the Lord. The fortunes of the Yadu dynasty and that of the inhabitants of the land of Mathura cannot be materially estimated. If simply by knowing the transcendental nature of the birth and activities of the Lord one can get liberation easily, we can just imagine what is in store for those who actually enjoyed the company of the Lord in person as a family member or as a neighbor. All those who were fortunate enough to associate with the Lord, the husband of the goddess of fortune, certainly obtained something more than what is known as liberation. Therefore, rightly, the dynasty and the land are both ever glorious by the grace of the Lord. Translation: how supremely glorified is the dynasty of King Yadu, and how virtuous is the land of Mathura, where the supreme leader of all living beings, the husband of the goddess of fortune, has taken his birth and wandered in his childhood. So, this is a verse in praise of not only Krishna, but his associates in the land of Mathura, Vrindavan, and the family of Yadu, etc. What is the significance? The reason I chose this verse is simply because it said there's a supreme leader of all beings. And I was supposed to speak on that, so on leadership. So I thought the supreme leader is Krishna. So that's what we have. So he is Pungsan Rishabha, the best of all beings, or humans, or jivas, or whatever. So yes, Krishna is the supreme leader. And we can't change that. His position is Ishvara, so, and we are jivas, so there's a big difference between us. So he is not only the leader in the sense of being Ishvara, but as Krishna, of course, he is Swayam Bhagavan. So even among the forms of God, he's also very special. In any case, all the forms of Bhagavan are special. The word Bhagavan itself means possessing Bhaga, and Bhaga is defined as six qualities, the first two of which are what? Aishvarya and Virya, which refer to as power. He controls everything. Aishvarya from Ishvara. So Isha means to control. So by his very nature, the Supreme Lord controls everything, and it can never be changed. It's fixed, and it's his swarup, his very nature. Huh? And, of course, virya, of course, means something similar to that. It also means heroism and powers. Our acharyas say that virya is distinguished from aishvarya by the fact that virya means he's got achintya shakti, inconceivable powers. So not only he's powerful, but his powers are beyond imagination and beyond logic and even contradictory, opposite of each other. His powers are such that they do impossible things. The Lord can do what is impossible. So that's his achintya shakti or his virya. So usually, of course, we associate leadership with power, etc. So these Aishvarya and Virya are naturally in the Supreme Lord, so that puts them in the highest position of leadership. Of course, we also have other qualities which we would appreciate. Different people have different expectations of their leaders. Everybody has a different idea of what a leader is. And of course, different people have different types of leaders, like we have political leaders, so you may expect one thing for that. Then you may have another type of leader or hero or whatever, or actor or whatever, or a dancer or a singer or whatever. So different people have different types of leaders. They don't care about the political leaders, but they have some other person in their mind as their ideal. So everybody has some sort of ideal, but unfortunately it's all material. So Krishna is the ideal, because he meets everybody's expectations. Whatever you could imagine is in Krishna, and everything wonderful. So, of course, in the Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami gives 64 qualities of Krishna. Of course, he has four special qualities, but even the 50 qualities are very wonderful. And we don't expect to find all these 50 in any of our leaders in the modern world or whatever. We don't find all those 50 qualities, even, which should be there in a good jiva, but we don't find them there in our modern leaders at all. Very wonderful qualities. And then we have the very special qualities of Krishna himself. So, can people hear back there? No. Oh, maybe better speak closer. Okay. So, Krishna is the ideal leader, and we can never hope to compete with him. We're doing leadership conference, but we cannot think we're ever going to be like Krishna. And that is not our ambition. Rather, there is a little bit of a difference. In other words, as devotees, we are trying to be servant of the servant of the servant, humbler than a blade of grass, etc. So we're doing the opposite. We're not trying to lead in one sense and compete with Krishna. We're only trying to be a servant. Of course, in the material world, it's the opposite. We are trying to compete with Krishna. We're trying to compete with him. That's literal in some cases. For instance, we'll see the story of Pondraka. He was a demon, but he was a most foolish demon because he wanted to imitate Krishna in every way. He even wanted his four arms. He wanted his chakra and his shankha. And he wrote a letter to Krishna, please give the shankha and chakra to me. It's mine, it's not yours. And when Krishna finally came to the battlefield, then Pondraka was a little worried, but he had two extra arms glued to his back like this, and he was sitting on his chariot. So he was a real fool, because even in form he was trying to imitate Krishna. But in the material world, of course, people are not so elaborately or even consciously imitating the Lord, but they are seeking some position of control and enjoyment, which is Krishna's position. So anyway, Krishna's at the very top, an ideal in every way. And as I said, he meets everybody's expectations very wonderfully, and we could say inconceivably. There's the description of Krishna and when he entered into the arena of Kamsa, and there's a very famous verse there that describes how everyone saw Kamsa, Krishna. There's one Krishna who entered into the arena, and everybody looked at him, and everybody saw him differently. So the women saw him as in Madhurya Rasa. They all fell in love with him as their consort. The wrestlers saw him as an opponent in Virya Rasa, and he was as hard as a thunderbolt. even though Krishna's actually as soft, is so soft that if he touches a leaf, it bruises him. But when the wrestlers saw him, he was harder than the thunderbolt. And it's the same Krishna that the women saw as their dear lover. And Vasudeva and Devaki saw him as a little child, unprotected, ready to get crushed by these wrestlers, whatever. And the Yadus, of course, saw him as their worshipable lord. And the yogis saw him as Brahman. They didn't see his beauty. This is peaceful. This is, you know. We can merge into him. So everyone saw him in a different way. And even the demons. Kamsa also saw Krishna, but what did he see him as? Death. Great fear. So everyone saw Krishna in a different way. And he satisfied their expectations. Everybody's expectation was satisfied. Simultaneously, everyone is completely happy with him. So that makes, of course, Krishna the ideal person, because anyone can approach him and anyone can get the highest bliss, and that bliss is eternal. That doesn't happen in the material world. Everybody's got a limitation, and people expect things of them, and it is never met. There's a difference then between the jiva and the Supreme Lord. So the Supreme Lord's ultimate. How does a devotee become a leader then, if it's rather contradictory that he should be a das, 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 anudas, etc. and at the same time be a leader, and a leader is like, you know, a material person who's got to control others. And of course, in the gunas, we have the kshatriya, who's an ideal leader. And what he's got a lot of rajagun in him and a little sattvagun. But as devotees, we're not trying to cultivate rajagun, definitely not. Maybe a little sattvagun's good, but definitely not rajagun. So how do we become leaders, you know, and lead the devotees if we're supposed to be transcendental, all this, and not compete with Krishna? So we see that if we take the example in our Sampradaya, we have, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then we have the Goswamis who followed him and sat in Vrindavan and wrote books, etc. Then we have Jiva Goswami, who wrote the Satsandarbhas. And they were all trying to fulfill the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu very nicely. So, yes, they were leaders also. And, of course, they had great respect from everyone. And Jiva Goswami also writes in the Satsandarbhas, at the end of the Satsandarbhas, he refers to the Vishva Vaishnava Raja Sabha, the assembly of the assembly of universal Vaishnavas. Or that means all the great Vaishnavas within the universe in a big assembly, headed by Rupa and Sanatana Goswami. So he mentions this assembly, this organization, so to speak, a group of people in his Satsandarbhas. We can, of course, say that maybe practically speaking, they never met as a big group anywhere, except this, of course, the six Goswamis were there in Vrindavan, but as, you know, a bigger group, to our material vision, they didn't meet anyway. But the idea was there that there was a group of devotees together appreciating the philosophy and the pastimes of Krishna and the process of bhakti as a group. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that's his appearance day to day, he mentioned later on, I think that was 1919, he mentioned this sabha. And it's very interesting how he mentions it, because at that time he established his first mat, the Chaitanya mat, in Mayapur, and then he came to Calcutta, and then he established a mat there. And then he says, we are establishing again this Vishva Vaishnava Raja Sabha, which is there in the time of Jiva Goswami and Rupa Goswami, and it kind of disappeared a little bit. It's eternal, but it didn't manifest. Then it manifested again with the works of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Baldev Vidyabhusan. Then it kind of disappeared again. And then it started appearing again with the appearance of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So we know, of course, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a very revolutionary preacher. He wrote a lot of his individual works as well as reviving original works. He wrote in Bengali, wrote in Sanskrit. He preached in different modes, creative modes, sometimes like short stories or novels or whatever. And he also wrote philosophical works. He preached to all sorts of people. He established the Nam Hat, originally established by Nityananda, but then he reestablished it as an organization. He also mentions the Vishvaishnava Raja Sabha in some of his lectures. Whether he actually formed it or not, I don't know, but he mentions it in some of his lectures that our group is like this, it's a Sabha. So that was a revival of this group again. And then Bhaktisiddhanta says, we are establishing this now. And that's when he established his Gaudiya Math organization. So if we look at the history of the Gaudiya Vaishnavas after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they, of course, the Nityananda and Lord Chaitanya and Gadadhar, Srivas, Pandit, etc., they all had groups of followers in their own groups. So there was some sort of organization. And Lord Chaitanya made some provisions for preserving the philosophy by having the Goswamis write works. And then Jiva Goswami had some plan, and therefore he got all the works of the Goswamis and sent it from Vrindavan to Bengal so they could take advantage of all of this, like that, and spread it there, get the philosophical basis straight. There was a huge gathering on Janava's time, Janava Mata's time. She, under her auspices, they all gathered all the prominent Vaishnavas of that time, including Narottam Das Thakur. They gathered together and had a huge festival in Khetri Gram, and they installed a lot of deities at the time, and they had kirtans and discourses, etc. So there was some organization there, getting together and discussing things and preaching and making plans. After that point in time, we see that a lot of the preaching took place with individuals rather than groups. Yeah. And this becomes what we know as the caste Goswami lines, that the people initiated in lines of hereditary, you know, gurus like this in different places in Bengal and Vrindavan and Orissa. So that continued until the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then he decided he wanted to really preach vigorously again, not within the lines of these caste Goswami groups with their temples, but rather to the public at large. And carrying on in that vein, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur therefore established the Gaudiya Math, and within, let's say, 16 or 17 years, he had established 64 maths within India, which was remarkable, again, and a few centers abroad also. He did this with very, very great determination. So we take Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur as great leaders in preaching. And particularly with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we see him very, very carefully planning out how to spread the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then he thought, we have to have an organization. So he made this whole structure of mutts with brahmacharis and sannyasis to do the preaching work and carry it on. So he was a leader. But we should not equate this type of leadership with the material leadership. Of course, we have gross material leadership in the modern world, and then we may have the varnashram leadership with the kshatriya who's in rajagun, sattvagun, whatever. So the Vaishnava leadership was a little different. It is not that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati strove to be a leader or chose to cultivate rajagun or sattvagun or whatever. He was just a Vaishnava. We look in the Chaitanya Charitamrita and Srimad Bhagavatam, we'll find the list of characteristics of a Vaishnava, such as tolerance and compassion, sense control, etc. We'll see many lists of qualities of devotees, 12th chapter also. But Bhagavad Gita, but what's the main quality? The main quality is surrender to Krishna. This is the primary quality of the devotee. And every other quality follows after that. And if you have every other quality, but you don't have that, useless. It's all material. So if you cultivate all these material qualities, but you don't have surrender to Krishna, what is it? Nothing. On the other hand, if you cultivate surrender to Krishna as a devotee, automatically the qualities follow. So that is the principle. Of course, also mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami says, what is the second quality of bhakti? That it is subhada, or bestowal of auspiciousness. And what is that auspiciousness? All good qualities appear. So with the cultivation of bhakti, then all wonderful necessary qualities for bhakti, for preaching, for leadership, etc., manifest themselves. So it's not a separate cultivation. It's something that automatically goes wrong along with the process of bhakti. So these are not, therefore, material things, as long as they are used for the service of Krishna. They become spiritualized. If we look at Krishna's qualities, we can't call those material qualities. He has sense control, he is gentle, he's compassionate. Those aren't material qualities, those are spiritual qualities. By doing bhakti, we associate with Krishna. Of course, bhakti is also the Srup Shakti of Krishna, so it's not different from Krishna. Krishna is full of all wonderful qualities. We associate with Krishna. The jiva also develops all good qualities. Well, at least 50 out of the 64. So, in this way, by doing bhakti, spiritual qualities should naturally develop. See, these are different from material cultivation of qualities in the gunas, either sattvic, rajic, or tamasic qualities. They're beyond that. They're actually spiritual qualities. They may look like material qualities, but they're not spiritual qualities. So those are the real qualities that the devotee will develop in the process of his bhakti. So, therefore, we strive to be the devotee, a wonderful devotee, a good devotee of the Supreme Lord. And in that process, then Krishna manifests in us whatever is necessary for our particular service and our particular mission. For instance, Prabhupada, he said, what did I do? I simply followed the order of my spiritual master. I wasn't trying to do this or that. I was just trying to fulfill his order. So that order of the spiritual master was his life and soul. That was his mode of bhakti. I should preach to everyone. I should preach to intelligent people in the Western world. I should somehow deliver the fallen souls of this world. That was his mission. That was his type mode of bhakti. And Krishna supplied everything. I'm just like a puppet in Krishna's hands. He pulls the strings and I do. So he wasn't separately striving for anything, this or that, but rather he concentrated on his goal and he got the intelligence and whatever else was necessary to fulfill that goal. So, as Gopal Bhatta has related the story of Giriraj Swami when he was a brahmachari then, he went to Prabhupada one night and then Prabhupada was very worried how this movement will continue. And then Giriraj said, well, okay, we follow the regular principle, we chant 16 rounds, everything like that, and then we'll continue. Good. It's a good answer, of course. We are steady in our bhakti, then the movement continues. And then Prabhupada thought for a moment and he was, you know, on the bed. And then he said, organization and intelligence. That doesn't mean we don't do the bhakti, but we also do something else along with the bhakti to help us. So in the Sankirtan movement, as I said, the movement expanded in different ways. We had Nityananda preaching and others preaching, and they were thinking of how to do things. So they were using their intelligence to write scriptures and to deliver those scriptures from Vrindavan to Bengal and to have meetings to unify the philosophy and unify the different groups of Vaishnavas together and different principles, etc. They were thinking in that way. It's not that they just did bhakti. And then we see with Bhaktivinoda Thakur and with Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur again, very systematically they began to plan out how to preach to people in the modern world. And not just in a limited way, but to go to different places, different groups, different countries of the world. And the further manifestation of that was the vision and work of Srila Prabhupada. So he carried that even a step further. So Prabhupada, of course, established International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That was his organization. It became quite a formal organization, unlike the loose organizations of previously where they had groups of people following a particular leader or the caste Goswamis with their families. That was their organization. So, of course, then Bhaktisiddhanta established the Gaudiya Math. Unfortunately, it broke up into many pieces. So Prabhupada established International Society for Krishna Consciousness. There are many centers in many countries of the world. This is a little bit different and maybe more difficult than Bhaktisiddhanta with 64 centers in India. So we have, 500 centers around the world in all sorts of countries. So how to keep that together? If 64 in India are going to break apart, if you got 500 around the world in different languages, how is that going to survive? So that was Prabhupada's worry. How is that going to continue? How are we going to continue? When Prabhupada was there on the planet, it wasn't such a problem because Prabhupada was the unifying force behind everything. Everyone was loyal to Prabhupada. He was the leader, and everyone followed him. So what do we do when Prabhupada disappears? That was his worry. Yeah? So he said organization and intelligence. So yes, we have the bhakti, and we have the organization that Prabhupada gave us. And of course, in that organization, we have GBC, Ultimate Managing Authority, and the whole system of temple presidents and devotees and congregations, etc. We have the process, chanting the holy name, festivals, worshiping the deities, prasad distribution, etc. Everything has been given to us. So what do we do? We follow that process. We follow the bhakti part, very important. And then again, we have to also see how to expand. In other words, ISKCON is not for simply sitting there. The whole purpose of the organization is not simply to preserve, but to expand the preaching. That's the whole purpose. Not simply to have a building, but rather to expand the preaching. So these are the principles that we, of course, have to safeguard our spiritual life as a devotee, and then we have to give devotion to others. This, of course, is summarized in the phrase Name Ruchi Jive Doya. To develop a taste for the name, that's our sadhana, our personal development. We have to do that. And as leaders also, and then giving out the mercy, that is preaching to others. These are the two elements of Lord Chaitanya's movement. So it's a dual. It's not just personal, but it's also giving out. But the two go together. You can't give out mercy unless you develop your own personal taste for Krishna and do your bhakti. So, therefore, how do we give it to everyone? We can do it individually, but Prabhupada established an organization as a more effective way of doing it, as did Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. They established organizations to do it. So we have a little assistance. We don't have to do it by ourselves. We have the whole organization, all the facilities that go with that. So it makes it a little easier. So not only that, the organization also tries to act in such a way that it acts not only now, but it also goes into the future. The whole idea of establishing an organization like ISKCON is to put it in the future. So that was Prabhupada's worry. How are we going to continue in the future, generation after generation? So the organization helps. If you have an organization, fine. If you don't have an organization, it tends to disperse. And we see that after Lord Chaitanya, there were no concrete organizations, the family units. So things got dispersed very easily and very quickly. Yeah? So Prabhupada is very intelligent. He uses intelligence to make an organization, and he made it in a particular way to spread all over the world and still have unity there under the governing body commission. So he has given us, let's say, the skeleton for, or the framework for, not only preaching in the present, but going into the future. So, getting back to leadership, how do we cultivate leadership? How do we become leaders? So basically, it's very simple. It is simply these two principles we have to follow. Develop your taste through your own sadhana, and then somehow or other, with your intelligence, you give it out to others. So that is also summarized in another way, which is the slogan of this festival, more devotees and happier devotees. Not only happier devotees, but the leaders should also become happier. They're devotees also. So we have to cultivate properly and develop a taste for the name and for Krishna and for all the aspects of bhakti, and we try to give that to everybody else, and by that sincere effort, anything can happen. So as we see, Srila Prabhupada said, I simply tried to sincerely follow the order of my spiritual master, take it as my life and soul. So we should also try to think of that as our life and soul, Prabhupada's Lord, how to preserve the movement now and in the future, how to spread Krishna consciousness everywhere, how to firmly establish it within ourselves. And if we take these two principles, then definitely we get the mercy of Prabhupada, we get the mercy of the previous acharyas and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We simply follow very, very basic principles, and then we succeed. So therefore, though we can use many different techniques or whatever, very good. But ultimately, it's based upon our surrender to the Supreme Lord. That is the main element. And following after the order of our spiritual master and founder, Acharya Srila Prabhupada. And if we do that, then we can be successful. Okay. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. That was very nice, very inspiring. In regards to Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, we can consider that we're all within his Saraswat, within the shelter of his teachings and vision, which Prabhupada has perfectly delivered to the whole world. Can you describe in any specific way how he packaged or made the great Gauravani, the great pure teachings of Lord Chaitanya, especially suitable for this exact modern age? By the way, that seemed to be Bhaktisiddhanta's genius that Prabhupada inherited.
Yeah.
Can you give any...
How Bhaktisiddhanta did it? Well, of course, everyone's individual. Bhaktivinoda talked about his individual way of doing that through his writings, particularly. And, of course, we see how he approached different types of people, intellectuals in one way, and maybe Sanskrit scholars in another way, and whatever. So he adapted according to his audience. He spoke in different ways, took the basic philosophy, and then presented it in different ways for different people, and even preached from different angles using different philosophies, even Western philosophies. So Bhakti Siddhanta, of course, also did the same thing. And as we know, he was highly intelligent, and we can say very intellectual on one level. So sometimes you can read his works so intellectual that you can't even understand them. But on the other hand, he was also very practical. So though he had very high intellect and he would sometimes express himself in that way, on the other hand, you'll find him very practical, particularly if you read his letters, for instance, instructing different devotees what to do or whatever. Very, very practical. He took the basic principles of the philosophy and applied it to the lives of those particular devotees and just gave them particular instructions. So that's one thing. The other, I would say, is how he preached in the modern world. He actually saw the pluses and minuses of the modern world. For instance, the printing press is good. We can print books and distribute them en masse, so that's good. We can use a vehicle. We can drive in a car. And we can ride in vehicles or airplanes or whatever. It doesn't matter, you know, even though previously people say, you know, sadhu cannot ride in a vehicle or go in an airplane. And some people still have that idea. The Madhvas say you can't go across the ocean. Sri Sampradaya says you can't go across the ocean. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, no, what's wrong? Go to England, go to Burma, go anywhere. So the details, he wasn't so much interested, but the main principles, and then he wanted to just preach everywhere. So whatever facilities were available, he tried to use those for spreading the movement and adapting things according to the situation and being very practical. So Prabhupada, of course, did the same thing, used things for Krishna's service very practically and very, we can say, simply for according to the audience. He would explain things in different ways and practically give instructions to the devotees.
You mentioned that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he developed an organization, but still it disintegrated.
Yeah.
Instead of having
So the question is that Bhaktisiddhanta established an organization, much more, let's say, formal than previous organizations, but still it fell apart. So what's the reason? Well, we all know what Prabhupada said, they didn't establish a GBC. They put one person in control, and then that created some conflicts, and eventually they all went off on their own, and they established individual mutts. So something survived in the sense that there were groups surviving, but they were all individuals rather than a group. So in other words, we had 64 mutts altogether under Bhaktisiddhanta. Afterwards, tend to separate into maybe 30 or 40 groups or something like that. So that was the problem because of individuals. So Prabhupada said they did not follow Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's order and establish not one manager, but a group of managers, the governing body and commission. So that's why they failed, he said. So that's why Prabhupada established the GBC.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Thank you for a wonderful class. Maharaj, we were hearing how the leader, he is in Namaruchi and Jivadoya, giving mercy to...
Not only leaders, everybody. Or everybody's a leader.
In regards to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, can you give some examples of his expressions of Jivadoya, not only externally preaching to the outside world, but internally to the members of the organization, expressing care for them?
Oh, I see. Well, for instance, he would inspect the ashrams very nicely, and he didn't want people criticizing other devotees, you know, because generally criticism, people take it and they feel uncomfortable. So he would always try to find something to praise in a person, even if they had faults. He would, you know, be very compassionate in that way to people. So he was caring for the devotees in the mutts. That's right. You mentioned how we have to develop taste for the name and preach. But it takes time to get ruchi. Then should we understand that if we preach without getting ruchi, we can't get the desired result? This is just a matter of what's the quantity, I suppose we can say. We can't wait until we get to the stage of ruchi after nishta to do anything. Or to get to prema or whatever. That's the real ruchi. So the idea is that if we practice sincerely the process of bhakti, chanting, associating, etc., this all actually develops because of an inclination called Shraddha, or faith. And the faith is not something in your mind. The faith is in the jiva. We become antarmukha. We turn towards Krishna instead of away from Krishna. So that's the jiva's decision and his inclination. When he is inclined towards Krishna, the jiva has faith. And then that develops into bhakti. So that is the initial taste. The Shraddha is a little bit of taste, and that turns into bhakti when we meet devotees and get some scriptural knowledge, and we begin to practice. So the Atma begins to practice the process of bhakti. And bhakti is non-different from Krishna. So therefore, we're getting the association of Krishna, so naturally, we develop more and more taste. So that's the ruchi. It may not be the technical stage of ruchi, but it is some taste for the Lord. So that has to remain intact. If we don't have that, and we go through all the external activities without any faith, it's not bhakti. We don't call it bhakti. That's always the qualification for bhakti is faith. Something happens in the jiva, and then it develops. So that further development, we can say, is the ruchi until it reaches technical ruchi stage after nishcha. But anyway, if you have a little faith, and that develops into a little bhakti, we can say a little ruchi is there, and that helps you in delivering the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If you don't have that at all, you don't have faith in your preaching, what is it? No potency at all. If you have that little taste, that little faith in the Lord, that potency goes into your preaching. That is the shakti in your preaching, whatever bhakti you have. And there's no bhakti there, and all the words are there, then there's no shakti. So it's a matter of degrees, that taste. So whatever taste you have, with that you preach. No taste, no preaching. Or preaching something else. Yeah, whatever position we're at, we don't say, well, I have to get to a higher stage before I can start preaching. You know, we can start preaching at the beginning stage, provided we do have some qualification of faith and a little bhakti and some guidance of devotees. Then we can do something. It may not be the highest potency, but it's something there. So we have one guru is the Bhartma Pradarshak guru. He may not even do anything, but you just meet the person that kind of does something to your Atma, and you start getting a little bit of faith and bhakti out of that. So that person didn't do anything, really. They may not be qualified to do anything, but just that contact produces some effect on the person, which stimulates bhakti. So that's another type of preaching. Of course, we hope that it's higher than that. We do have some knowledge and some, you know, bhakti that we can impart to another person. But even if it's not at that level, there's effect. But some sort of faith has to be there.
Hare Krishna. In your lecture you mentioned about that Srila Prabhupada mentioned that I try to sincerely follow my spiritual master's orders. Yeah. So sometimes in our moment we find that saying this is how Srila Prabhupada said that this is the way it has to be followed, and that creates more issues rather than taking us forward or things like that. So how we can understand that in this context, as you said, that sincerely following the spiritual master's order.
I think you're referring to the fact that, well, Prabhupada didn't do it like that, he did it like that, and this is not just one service, but in general, we have to do it only this way and not that way, you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, when Prabhupada says follow the order, the particular order, he got a particular order from Bhaktisiddhanta. That was one thing, that you preach to the intelligent people, the English language, like that. So that was a particular order. The other order, of course, which is actually his inspiration, is in the Bhagavad Gita, the commentary of Vishnu Thakurvati Thakur on Devasatmaka Buddhi, or with one-track intelligence. very concentrated intelligence. So in there, Vishnu Thakurvati says that you take the order of your spiritual master as the life-giving, life-supporting medicine. And if you don't take the medicine, you die. So you have to take the order, and if we don't follow the order, we're finished, you know, like that. And what was the order? The order was actually to serve the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. So that's, of course, the ultimate order of all the spiritual master's instruction. You serve this way or serve that way. Ultimately, it's some engagement in the service of the Lord to please the Lord. So basically, he's trying to engage us in bhakti and keep us at the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. That's the main order. So, now Prabhupada gave many instructions to many people, and we have to be very careful, of course, that some of the instructions are for particular persons at particular times. And then at another time, he may give another instruction to another person, which is different. So there may be contradictions there. So we can't take just one instruction and see it in isolation. So other instructions he gives are general, like follow the four regular principles or whatever. That's common for everybody. We can't interpret those things. So we have to have a little bit of intelligence to see which instructions are particular for particular persons and maybe relative in that sense, and others which are for everyone, are fundamental instructions. Okay? So that, of course, is also takes a little work, and that is also the responsibility of, let's say, GBC or whatever, to figure out what the fundamental instructions are. So we follow those, and the other ones may or may not follow according to the circumstance. I think maybe. Yeah. I'm finished. He's about one question.
I've heard from authorities that, you know, Prabhupada was saying to get a bona fide guru is very, very difficult, right? But you're very fortunate, the soul who gets.
Mm-hmm.
But it was explained that, you know, it's even harder to find a bona fide disciple. So can you speak a little bit on this?
Well, we can take it, of course, in the extreme way that nobody's qualified at all. But obviously, in the material world, the Vaishnavas are very merciful, and therefore they try to help everyone, even people who may not so qualified, and bring them up to qualification. But of course, what is qualification? Qualifications got very many levels also. We're qualified to begin bhakti, we're qualified to be on this level or that level, higher and higher levels. So there's very different qualifications. The qualification for bhakti is, as I said, not too demanding. It is simply shraddha, inclination towards the Lord. If that is there in the jiva, that's your qualification to develop, you know. So that's not so difficult, but we have to look for that in persons, of course, see who has real shraddha and who doesn't. That's mainly the point, I suppose. The guru has to see who has real shraddha and who has maybe fake shraddha. They're trying to be a disciple for the wrong reasons. So that has to be seen. Yeah, of course we have to see the statement in the context as well. You know, this one. We're over time, I think. We have half hour to get to our seminars. Yeah, I think we should end here because of the seminars on time. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. ILS announcement. This morning we start at 9:30. There's no breakfast. We start at 9:30 with the plenary. Please be on time. And it's very appreciated if the kirtan party goes 10 minutes before. Thank you. Hare Krishna.